and welcome to the 80th edition of the House of Comments podcast. My name is Emma Burnell and I'm a Labour supporting blogger, blogging at the Scarlet Standard. And joining me today, as always, is my friend Mark Thompson, who is a Lib Dem blogger. Hello, Mark.
Hello.
And we had two guests last week, some of you may have been aware. I think we got quite a bit of traffic for that one. But this week we've decided to strip it back to its essentials, and it will just be me and Mark chatting policy. And we may or may not call each other horrid names.
I'm going to try and not call you anything horrid, Emma, but, you know, it's up to you whether you wish to reciprocate.
Well, I'm sure that you are less likely to wind me up than Toby Young. I think there are very few people in the world more likely to wind me up than Toby Young.
Well, let's give it a go, shall we? Don't count your chickens.
Yeah, you can always do your best. I'm sure we'll have some fun over our various ding-dongs. So, we thought we'd open up today with the discussion of the Royal Mail privatisation. The Coalition have sold shares in Royal Mail. They were valued at £3.30 a share, and many are saying that that was too cheap. Many are also saying that we never should have sold it in the first place and that this is a privatisation too far. Some of those would also say some of the other privatisations were privatisations too far. We shall see whether the Royal Mail becomes as innovative as Network Rail or as customer-friendly as a utility company, or possibly even as service-focused as BT. With someone who's moving flats knows how very quickly it is possible to get your new phone line put in. Mark, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, just quickly, I mean, I think the privatisation of BT was actually a very good thing. I think it liberalised the telecoms market and, you know, brought in a lot of competition and I think stimulated innovation. I mean, I'm sure a lot of the things that have happened with telecoms would have happened anyway, but I think they'd have been slower, there'd have been, you know, I think it wouldn't have happened in the way it has done. But I think for most of the other privatisations, I think I'm probably in agreement with you, certainly the utilities and the railways. The post office is, I guess we're going to have to wait and see. I mean, I think there's quite a lot of international precedent for this sort of thing. So it's not just come out of, you know, clear blue sky. And I know that Labour looked at this. I know they eventually didn't do it. But, you know, it's not like this. It doesn't feel to me like this is a particularly ideological privatisation. I feel like it's one of those things that probably in the next 5 or 10 years, whoever was in it would have come eventually. But as to whether it's a good idea or not, like I say, we'll have to wait and see. Whether it was priced correctly, I think is a more vexed question, because I'm not sure that this could ever have been privatised correctly. I don't think there is a correct way. I did a cheeky little flowchart the other day, which demonstrated how you could have opposed it, whatever had happened. I think if it had been priced too low, like it seems it probably was really, or certainly that argument could be made, then obviously you can complain it was priced too low, it was sold off too cheap, you know, selling off the family silver too cheap. If the price hadn't risen at all but hadn't dropped either, you could claim it was a flop, you know, that it hasn't gone anywhere, what was the point? And, you know, if it was priced too highly, then you could say that all the people, or, you know, the public who've invested in it have been ripped off. So I'm not really sure that it tells us very much. One thing I do think, though, is that I think the people who invested in this will now be very happy. I think, unfortunately,
10 million shares were sold on within 30 seconds.
Exactly.
So those people are pretty happy.
Exactly.
I'm not sure that they were the like average little household, because actually there were quite a few smaller investors who weren't allowed to come into this privatisation.
Yeah, I think the minimum was 750, wasn't it? Which would rule out quite a lot of people. I remember when British Telecom
was privatised. It was not a Telsid.
No, well, yeah, when British Telecom and when gas was privatised, yeah, there were a lot of small investors. I don't know what the limit, I'm sure there must have been a minimum limit, but I'm sure it was way lower than 750. So, the people who banked the profits are going to be happy. And the reason I think that's quite salient is because we mustn't forget that the state currently either owns outright or owns massive proportions of several banks that they're going to want to be flogging off in the next few years. And I think the happier that people are having bought shares in something that was privatised quite recently, like the post office, the more likely those sales are to be a success and to be quite heavily subscribed as well. So I don't know whether the government planned it like that, but I think they've set the ground.
So you think they underpriced the Royal Mail shares in order to tempt people to buy RBS?
No, I don't think they deliberately did that. And actually, I think trying to price the post office was a very difficult thing. And it remains to be seen whether the current price is right, because I've just suddenly got an image of Leslie Crowther in my head.
Come on down!
Yeah, because I've lost my train of thought now with that thought. It remains to be seen whether it's the price it's kind of risen to, shot up to within the first day or two of trading, is sustainable, because there's potential for quite a lot of industrial strife coming down the line pretty soon. And that could cause all sorts of problems. It may turn out that £3.30 is actually around about the right long-term price for it. I don't think
setting a long-term price, clearly, because people could sell instantly.
Yeah, I don't think the government deliberately priced it too low. I think it's a very difficult thing to work out, you know, something that had never been in private hands before. But what I'm saying is that it may turn out serendipitously for it to encourage people to invest in future state sell-offs of the banks, which, you know, may turn out to be a good thing in the longer term.
I'm not wholly sure that we should be selling off the banks, but that's a whole nother vexed question.
you think that the state should keep hold of them?
I think we should be mutualised, possibly. I think there are other options than simply floating it as a private company.
But a bit like I said at the start, whichever government is in, they're going to want to get shut of them. They're not going to want to be running banks in 10 years' time. They're just not.
It isn't an either or, though. There are other options. There are other ways of doing this. They could break it up and actually stop having a bank that's too big to fail.
Well, I certainly think there are things that should be done that haven't been done yet as regards, the regulation to try and make sure that what happened can't happen again. Because frankly, at the moment, it could happen again. But I don't think the state, you know, trying to keep hold of banks and trying to enforce some kind of mutualized structure on them is the right way to go. I think the private sector, just there needs to be regulation to make the private sector work.
There needs to be regulation to make the private sector work. That doesn't mean that privatized banks are the only option. If you look at the rise of, particularly in the States, of credit unions, absolutely extraordinary movement, which is fledgling over here, but is starting to take off.
Well, I'm actually more encouraged by what I've heard about in places like Germany, which have a lot more local banks. So they have like big national banks and multinational banks, but they have a lot of these local banks that only cover like particular provinces, or, you know, are very big in certain areas, you know, in certain towns or cities, but then are pretty much unheard of outside of those towns and cities. And what they have is what we used to have here, which is bank managers that know the customers, that are willing to lend to the customers on the basis of, you know, what they know about them, rather than computer says yes, computer says no. And in fact, you know, I say it's kind of harking back to the way things used to be here. Actually, the reason why we used to have all these building societies called things like the Cheshire and the Leeds and Birmingham Midshires, and, you know, there were hundreds of them, probably thousands all across the country. And the ones with the regional names and the local names did tend to just be focused in specific areas, but they got flogged off, they got subsumed. I mean, you know, there are banks now that are actually made up of, you know, whatever the original bank was, plus about 40 different building societies that have been merged in various ways into them over the years. So, you know, I think we've lost something there. And I think we could get back to that. There was actually a program last year, which I think I might have mentioned on this podcast before, called Bank of Dave, about a guy who was actually trying to set up a bank. Dave Fishwick, his name is. He's an entrepreneur who'd made a lot of money out of, I think it was trucks and delivery services and stuff. And he tried to set up a bank, and there were a lot of problems. In the end, he wasn't able to set up a bank because of all the regulation. But he very much just wanted kind of one or two outlets, and he was very hands-on, and he was going around speaking to, like, there was, I think, a local chip shop that wanted, like, some new equipment to expand, and they hadn't been able to get a loan from a bank because, you know, times are tough and they couldn't make the business case. But he went and had a chat with them, sat down, eyeballed them, chatted for an hour, saw the place, and gave them a £10,000 loan, you know, exactly like it used to happen many years ago. And I think, you know, I think that sort of thing may end up being part of the future, maybe linked to this kind of, you know, peer-to-peer thing as well that we were talking about with, you know, with Carl Packman a couple of months ago.
I mean, coming back to the Royal Mail, that is one of the big concerns about this privatisation, is that that localised services will be what really suffer. At the moment, it costs 36p or whatever it is. I can't remember how much a stamp costs.
No, it's 59p, Emma. You're way behind the times.
Isn't it 36p for a second class?
Do we even have second class stamps anymore? I don't know.
Yeah, I've always used second class stamps.
All right. I'm showing my poshness now.
Yeah. However much, yeah, they cost the same in, you know, the outflung reaches of the Scottish Islands and John O'Groats and, you know, Land's End as they do in central London. And you still get the same guarantees of delivery. Now, we all complain about delivery and we all have a little moan about the post. But actually, I get post through my door every day. And so do people in the far-flung islands of Scotland, John O'Groats, Land's End. And that is a real worry, that there will not be that continuity of service across the country, and that people who are already quite remote will be further remote because, as a result of this.
Mm. If I lived less able
to access services.
Yeah, if I lived in John O'Groats or Land's End, I'd have to have a pen pal in the other place. Just, you know, just so I could regularly send letters between the two. Yeah, I mean, I don't know what's going to happen about that, because there's been this question mark over, you know, basically privatising the profitable bits and nationalising the non-profitable bits and the pension and all the rest of it. But like I say, I mean, I think most post office organisations around the world are now either partly or wholly private. So I think we're just going to have to wait and see. It's too early to say. What I do know is that my grandfather, my grandy, as we used to call him, would probably be spinning in his grave. He worked for the post office for many years. And, you know, he was very much socialist in his outlook. And I think he'd be appalled by this. But I don't know. I suppose times have moved on, haven't they?
I agree. There is also one other myth that I wanted to lay to rest. I think relates to your grandy, who probably, if he was working, would have been offered shares, and almost certainly, like the other 90% of people, would have accepted them, because you don't turn down free money. Mm. That doesn't mean that you ideologically support the sale.
No.
That seems to have been something that has been conflated rather a lot in some of the commentary around this.
Yeah, it reminds me of some of the criticism of the Occupy movement. But they're using iPhones. How can you possibly be against capitalism? Yeah, it doesn't really work like that. You have to live in the world in which you live in, don't you?
Exactly. I mean, I don't think it was a good idea. I think that time will prove me right. But maybe we should wait and see, and then I can say I was proved right. The problem is that once I'm proved right, what happens? We can't go back. It's very hard. I mean, we could renationalise it, but it seems very unlikely.
Yeah. Did they not have an if Emma's proved right sunset clause within the legislation?
You know, so much would be better in this world if all legislation had an if Emma was proved right sunset clause.
Okay.
Don't you think the world would be a better place?
You start the campaign.
I'll get myself a 38 degree petition. Emma's Scarlet Standard sunset clause.
There you go.
I mean, yeah, let's wait and see. But the problem with let's wait and see is, as you say, wait and see and then what? Mm. And that is a concern for people who rely on the post office, for small businesses, particularly small businesses in further flung places who really do rely on some of these services. Will they be severely detrimental to them? I think they probably will. I think that will show within... probably not immediately, but within a few years. And what will happen is that there won't be anything for a year or so, and everyone will go, oh, it's fine, really. And then it will gradually be run down. And will, in the same way that the utilities and the railways have become a disaster.
Well, I mean, I'm going to show my ignorance now, but I mean, I think the reason why the telecoms flotation, and actually British Airways as well, That's another one that I would say was a you know, a good privatisation in my view, is because it was linked to competition. So, you know, in the case of BT, it felt like a natural monopoly in the 70s and early 80s, but actually the technology was such that it really did allow proper competition in there. And obviously similar with British Airways. But with this, is there going to be competition? Are you going to be able to...
Well, that's the concern, isn't it? Are they going to be competing to deliver to far-flung villages? And if not, what happens to those people?
Yeah, I think that's the potential sticking point. But yeah, we keep saying it. We are going to have to wait and see. I can only hope that there are mechanisms in place to, you know, to encourage, you know, to encourage good things to happen in that way. But who knows?
The other thing to mention, finally on this, as a parting shot, is that anybody who is claiming that you can't say that the price was put at the wrong level and you never know with these things, I hope none of them have ever used the words Gordon Brown and gold in the same sentence.
I don't think I've ever criticised Brown for the gold sell-off. A lot of people have. I don't think I'm one of them. I might be wrong, but I don't think so.
So there you go. So let's see whether how many people. I'm betting that certain websites I can think of, Guido Fawkes, to name but one, will have done both of those things at once.
Yeah, but you know, Guido, it's not his job to be consistent, is it?
No, it's his job to be something else, which I'm not going to say this week.
Yeah, we said we weren't using that word.
And I haven't.
Well done.
Okay, so I think we've done the Royal Mail to death. Let's see if the government have. moving on. We had a reshuffle, which we haven't really discussed. There was a reshuffle on both sides of the aisle.
All three sides.
Sorry, well, you're on one side now. You're in government together. It's kind of one reshuffle.
There's kind of a Chinese wall between the Lib Dems, and you can call it a Chinese aisle if you want, between the Lib Dems and the Tories on the other side of the actual aisle. So,
but certainly there were some interesting moves within the government. I'm trying to think of key people who lost seats. Justine Greening, she's been demoted or left?
Yeah, she left, didn't she? But I think it was jump before push.
She was pushed. Well, yeah, I mean, she didn't turn up to the Syria vote. That's kind of going to be a thing, I would have thought.
Yeah.
And on the Lib Dem side, Jeremy Brown was sacked.
Mm-hmm.
Fairly harshly, as far as I can tell. It didn't seem to have been done in a very soft manner.
No.
And Norman Baker has been brought into the Home Office from Transport, which is... an interesting move for him for a number of different reasons, all of which we'll discuss. The first being that Norman Baker may well be pushing a much more Liberal Democrat line on drugs policy.
Mm-hmm.
The second, which if we take the drugs first, but we'll then go on to other issues that Norman Baker might have with the Home Office. But if you want to go into some of the things that he's been saying or that may now happen in terms of Lib Dems and drug policy...
Well, yeah, I mean, he is. He has very strong Liberal credentials and he is pretty popular with the party base, you know, the activists, for that reason, really. You know, he has a very strong campaigning record as well. And I mean, I think the feeling when it comes to drugs, I mean, drugs is one of these issues that, you know, is kind of one of the ones that I tend to bang on about quite a lot, although in the last year or two I kind of haven't banged on about it that much, maybe because I got a bit tired of it, because I kind of get the feeling that no matter what the evidence says and no matter what good ideas you see coming out of other countries, whoever is in government in this country for whatever reason just is deaf to the evidence, and it's just they just want to be seen as tough on drugs all the time, in quotes, because I actually think, you know, reforming the drugs laws would be being tough on drugs, you know. I mean, there's this review that Jeremy Brown was in the middle of when he lost his job, although I think he'd finished the main part of it, which was travelling around to various places like Portugal and the United States and I think places in South America as well, to try and gather evidence, really, on... you know, best practice and what people are doing. And Nick Clegg gave an interview where he basically talked about how he thinks things need to change. He actually said this a few months ago. In fact, he said it to me when I interviewed him at Lib Dem conference last year. That's the first time I really remember him talking about this. in any detail. So I'm not claiming I broke the story, because I'm sure he'd have talked about it anyway, but maybe no one had thought to ask him for quite a while when I asked him the question. And he was quite frank. He said that, you know, the Home Office Select Committee that was due to report a couple of months hence, so that it ended up reporting last December, he said that if the report, he said, as these reports usually do, say that, you know, we really need to look at changing things, then, you know, we should be very open to that, which is about as close as a deputy prime minister can get, I think, to, you know, saying that really we should be legalising drugs. I don't think he actually wants to say the words, but that's pretty much what he meant. And the feeling now seems to be that with Baker in the position of drugs minister, that it's definitely going to be a point of very strong campaigning for the party. Now, I suspect the Lib Dems aren't going to be able to force through what they want. And what is actually Lib Dem policy? Ewan Hoyle, who is head of an organisation called Lib Dems for Drug Policy Reform, piloted through some changes to the party's policy a couple of years ago. And, you know, it is all about, you know, things being evidence-based. And, you know, he has a very strong view, and actually LDDPR in general and most people involved in it do, that the drug policy should not be under the purview of the Home Office. It should be under the Department of Health. And that is one of the things that I saw in these comments from Clegg, that seems to be what's being pushed. And actually, it's pretty difficult to argue against that. If that was all you were asking for, that is actually quite a reasonable thing. And it almost feels like that is potentially achievable if it's played in the right way. But I have to say, I am sceptical about this. Just sceptical as to whether anything will change, rather, because we're now 18 months away from a general election.
Yeah,
I just can't see the Tories bending on this. I think no matter what the evidence says, and you've seen it from Cameron, you know, in 2002, he was a member of a Home Office Select Committee report that talked about how drugs laws should be, there should be like a Royal Commission, and that we should look at, you know, changing the status of cannabis. And he signed up to that. Now, he has since tried to row back from that. And I actually, but I'm making this all about me today, aren't I? I questioned him about this in a Cameron Direct event in Reading just before the 2010 general election. And he basically tried to say that there was a lot of good stuff in that report, but he personally didn't agree with the cannabis bit. But I talked to someone from Transform Drugs Policy Foundation afterwards, and they said that's not true. He signed up to the whole thing, and he was for it at the time. It's just that as he got closer to power, basically, he realised that it's a third rail issue and he wasn't going to touch it, and he was going to just, you know, fall back on the same formulation of words that all politicians do. So whether anything will change, I don't know. But definitely there seems to be a much stronger line from the Lib Dems on this. And I, for one, am very, very happy about that. You know, it's one of the things that, you know, makes me happy to be a Lib Dem, knowing that my party, I'm very much in tune with my party on this issue.
I don't disagree with you on the policy at all. I also don't disagree with you on the fact that I don't think it's going to happen. Mm. I think the question for you and for your party is, what do you do about it not happening?
Yeah.
And how much of a priority can or should you make it in any future coalition negotiations, if there are future coalition negotiations? Because if it's all very well for the Lib Dems to have a lovely, fluffy, cuddly-wuddly policy, and I agree with their lovely, fluffy, cuddly-wuddly policy, but there's no point in just having it in your back pocket to say we have it, if any time you get the chance to implement it and you have a drugs minister in the government for 5 years, nothing happens.
Okay, well, I think the Tories, I think it's pretty clear that they're not going to do anything about it. And I think that's probably going to be true forevermore unless things change. So I could imagine in, let's say, 30 years time, if cannabis was legalised and, you know, there were various other changes and that had happened in other governments, the Tories probably wouldn't row back from that. They probably wouldn't repeal that, and they'd probably just go along with it. But I don't think they're ever going to make it happen.
Mm.
But I think Labour possibly might. It depends which faction's in control of the Home Office at the time, because people like Jack Straw and John Reid, you know, there was just David Blunkett, you know, there was no chance that drug laws were going to be, you know, seriously liberalised. I know that Blunkett downgraded cannabis from B to C, and I thought that was a really good thing. But the idea that he was going to go any further than that was just you know, just no chance. But what do you think, Emma? Because you obviously agree with this and you're a member of the Labour Party.
Yeah.
I mean, what do you pick up from kind of internal debates about this? Do you think it's possible?
There are very, very few internal debates about this, which is why I don't think it's very likely to happen.
So even if there was a Lib Dem Labour coalition at some point, which is quite possible in the next 5 or 10 years, that could happen. And let's say the Lib Dem said, look, you know, we really want to do something about
it.
Here's the evidence.
I think that probably there could be moves on cannabis if they made it a red line. I don't think the Lib Dems would make it a red line, and I don't think Labour would push it from the other direction.
See, I think
the thing with Labour that is a lot of people who are Labour in metropolitan areas forget is that there's a very, very strong Methodist core to the Labour Party that is, you know, we're talking about people who were anti-alcohol back in the day, well, still are to a certain extent. The social conservatism on some issues, particularly around drugs, particularly any issue that's linked to poverty, which addiction often is going to be very, very controversial within the Labour Party. I mean, say, for example, if it did move to health and Andy Burnham was the health secretary, I think Andy Burnham's very unlikely to move on anything like this.
Yeah, I mean, it's ironic, though, isn't it? Because it's poor people who are most badly affected by the drugs, you know, by drugs and by, in my view, the drugs laws.
Because I agree with you. I absolutely agree with you. But it is also poor people who see people buying and selling drugs on their doorsteps and people passed out having taken drugs on their stairwells. And it's very, very hard, although I believe it to be right, to make the leap that that will happen less if drugs are legalised.
Well, I mean, I think it would. And I think, you know, draw historical parallels. You've got to look at what happened in 1920s USA when alcohol was prohibited.
I'm not arguing with you, Mark. I'm saying these are the arguments you'll come up against.
I know. But what I'm saying is that it's the argument I've just said there about prohibition is exactly the kind of argument you can use when campaigning and when talking to people who maybe haven't, you know, see like the depredation that drugs can cause and don't necessarily see that, you know, if drugs were legalized, because I think people who are opposed to drugs legalization and, you know, and reform of the drugs laws have an easier job in this situation. I think it's partly what I've said many times before, which is that this country is conservative with a small c. You know, this country doesn't like change, and it's very easy to make the knee-jerk reactionary argument against change. You know, oh, you can't legalize drugs, it might look how bad it is now, it'd be 10 times worse, and not really engage with the argument and just leave it there as if that's just obvious, when actually, if you look at places like Portugal, you know, if you look at places, you know, where a more pragmatic and a more sensible and a more health and evidence-based approach to drugs has been taken, actually, you know, disease is down, crime is down, you know, it has all kinds of beneficial effects, but it does take time to get that message across. And I don't think that the message is being pushed hard enough. I think if the Lib Dems can make a good fist of this campaign, then it will help people more to understand what the potential consequences of reforming the drugs laws are. Because I think it's too easy to just allow the people who want to keep the status quo in place to just go by default. And I think it does take a little bit of engagement with the discussion. But I actually do think, honestly, that in 15 or 20 years' time, I think we will have some form of liberalisation of drugs laws. I just think, you know, I'm on the side of history in this, and we see it across the world. You know, now that we've got a couple of states in the US that have legalised cannabis, not just for medical use, but for general use, that's the way things are moving. It's just, I think, like I say, it's difficult to make the argument. And just coming back to your point about whether Lib Dems will make it a red line, I don't think they will make it a red line. The reason is because I think there will be a number of other policies that they will consider to be the ones that they really want to get in any coalition agreement. And the one on drugs will be the one that they'll just trade away for something else. As sad as it makes me to say it, because I think that actually the benefits that you could get if drugs laws were liberalised in this country properly, you know, done in a proper way. So it's not going to be a free for all, because this is another myth. You know, kids will be, you know, buying crack on street corners and stuff. That happens already. The whole point is it would actually make it harder for children to get hold of drugs, you know, and like I say, the health benefits and all the other benefits that would come from it. You know, I think actually it would really help poor people, and I think it would really help society as a whole. So for me personally, you know, if I was Nick Clegg or if I was in the negotiating team, it would be right up there. You know, for me, maybe 1, 2, 3. I don't know. It would be somewhere in that list where I'd be really pushing for it. But I just don't think people in the senior echelons of the party agree with me to that extent. They might agree with the policy, but I don't think they agree with the priority that I'd place on it.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I'm not going to argue with you about the policy because I agree with you. I agree with you on the impact it could have. I think about, I was walking down the street the other day, bloke walks past me, and I got high off the fumes of the, you know, the quite obviously very, very strong marijuana joint he was smoking. And I just thought, well, you know, he's walking down the street, you know, there are police cars going past us, prohibition is not working, you know, and all it's doing is meaning that when he goes to buy his illegal drug of choice, plenty of other illegal drugs of choice are openly available. Mm-hmm. And unregulated. And it means that one of the things that I've noticed is that I don't take any drugs anymore. I have done in the past. I'm completely open about that. But I noticed I stopped smoking dope about 10 years ago because you couldn't get nice dope anymore. It was just, you just got stuff that just made you feel sick and sleepy and horrid rather than giggly and fun and up.
Yeah.
And but... you can't, it just seems to me that if you had a legalized trade in marijuana, you could actually have marijuana that was of a certain quality rather exactly. than simply the most horrible deep skunk that you can find.
Exactly. So, you know, and again, this is an argument, I mean, not what you just said, but an aspect of that is an argument that's used by people who don't want reform of the drugs laws, in that they say, well, it was all very well 30 years ago, 20 years ago, you know, cannabis was different, but now it's super killer skunk, even though there is no evidence that marijuana has actually ever killed anyone. Although, you know, there are some question marks over schizophrenia and correlation and links and all the rest of it. But again, to draw my parallel with 1920s America, when alcohol was prohibited, suddenly what people were drinking was 60, 70, 80% proof alcohol. Yeah. People went blind. People died. You didn't know whether what you were drinking was 30%, 40% or twice that. So, you know, that's what happens in an unregulated market. You know, we're having to relearn the lessons of history all over again. I mean, I could keep making this argument for hours. Obviously, it sounds like you agree with me.
Yeah.
In principle. I
agree with you in principle. And I think we both probably agree about what the politics are around it. Mm. However disappointing we may personally find that.
But I am encouraged by the fact that this is being pushed now by the Lib Dems. You know, I've been pretty disappointed in the first 2/3 of this government that really they didn't really try and do anything about it at all. I was particularly disappointed with Jeremy Brown. I actually gave him a bit of a monstering at a Fringe event back in Lib Dem conference a few weeks ago. Where, I mean, I had the first question in the Fringe, surprise, surprise. It tends to be my way. And I really tore into him, actually, about what happened with Cat. With the Home Office, where they made it illegal, and that's just, as far as I'm concerned, discriminatory in all kinds of ways and anti-liberal, you know, Somalian and Ethiopian communities and Yemeni communities, you know, being discriminated against and all the rest of it. And he didn't really have an answer for me. And In the end, I kind of felt like, because I really did have quite a big go at him, and I kind of felt a bit sorry for him in the end. Because I suspect he probably deep down agreed with me, but wasn't able to say so because of the position he was in. Well, he's not in that position anymore, so maybe next time I see him, I'll ask him and see if he's able to be a bit more open about it. Maybe genuinely.
If the classic ex-Home Office minister suddenly goes liberal situation. Yeah.
Well, we'll see. I mean, maybe he genuinely did agree with the policy, but I don't know. It's... yeah, but I think with Baker in position, I think Baker will just give less of a shit, frankly, about what people think and about how much it might piss
people. And that might move us on to the second half of this discussion.
Yeah.
Norman Baker not giving a fig about what people think. It is very, very odd to have a minister in the Home Office who has written the book implicating MI5 in the cover-up. Not, I believe he didn't say they killed him. They believe he was MI5 were implicated in the cover up of the death of Dr. David Kelly, which frankly is nonsense. How can he be in charge of MI5?
Well, I mean, I've heard this argument. My instinct when I first heard he'd been appointed was to go, huh? Because over the summer, I read a book by David Aronovitch called Voodoo Histories, which is a brilliant book. If you know, if anyone listening hasn't read it and you're interested in conspiracy theories and the history of conspiracy theories, it's very worth reading. And he covers the death of David Kelly, and in particular Norman Baker's views on it. And I mean, all the classic conspiracy theory tropes are there. You know, cherry picking the evidence, only listening to one side, very much not applying what's known as Occam's razor, which is a very useful principle in philosophy, which is, it really boils.
The most likely to be true is probably true.
Exactly. In the vast majority of cases, you know, that is correct. Whatever seems to be most likely is almost certainly what happened. And in David Kelly's case, very sad, but I think what happened is he was traumatized by what had happened with his, you know, his being in front of the select committee, and he wandered out into the woods and took his own life. But Norman Baker obviously took a different view and felt strongly enough to write a book about it. And I was very disappointed in that, because as a liberal and a liberal Democrat, I really like to think that, you know, we follow the evidence on things. And it really strikes me that there's quite a lot in his thinking that has led to his conclusions on that that aren't really based in evidence very strongly at all. Having said that, like I said, he is very popular with, you know, with the party. He has very strong campaigning credentials. And I've even seen some people within the Lib Dems make the comment that they're actually glad that they've got someone who has a very sceptical eye about how the security services work in the Home Office, keeping an eye on everything. And I suppose in a perverse way, there is something in that. At least you've got someone who is, you know, who is sceptical, who isn't just going to take everything at face value.
I would worry about that, because my contention on that would be, it would be great to have someone who's a bit more sceptical about the security services, not simply saying yes to every ask. But if they have degraded their credibility, I think it probably is less helpful than helpful.
I mean, I can see that argument. I mean, is this the equivalent of maybe Michael Meacher having been a government minister? Would that be the Labour?
Yeah, I'm very embarrassed that Michael Meacher can call himself a former Labour minister, yeah, and then go around spreading 9/11 conspiracy theories, which I've written about in the past. I think incredibly damaging, particularly to the anti-war movement.
Yeah, I was watching Edge of Darkness a few years ago, and I was amazed to see Michael Meacher was actually in it. I think he was playing himself.
God.
It's a program about a kind of nuclear conspiracy theory, nuclear power, nuclear weapon conspiracy theory. And he's there. This was made in about 1986. So I think he was an MP at the time. Anyway, we're getting slightly off the point here. Like I say, I think it's very brave for Nick Clegg to put him in that position. And I think it actually does send quite a strong message out. Because I wouldn't have expected, I would never have called this. I just wouldn't have called it. Especially not Clegg sacking Jeremy Brown and then appointing Norman Baker. I just never would have called that.
Yes, and obviously there's been some speculation about Jeremy Brown and whether he's ready now to jump ship. Now, my personal opinion is that if he was going to do that, he would have done it for the Sundays last week. So he probably is going to stick with the Lib Dems. But what hasn't happened, as far as I'm aware, is him coming out and ending that speculation.
No, I haven't heard him come out and end it. But then, you know, I'm sure in months, years to come, if he doesn't defect, then he'll just say, well, you know, I don't comment on speculation. And that's a standard politician's formulation for this sort of thing, isn't it?
Well, it is and it is. I mean, in Charles Kennedy, when there were rumours about him defecting, you know, he was Lib Dem, he'd be yellow to his boots in the furnace or something like that. I can't remember the exact quote, but yeah, he'd be burned with his Lib Dem membership card kind of thing.
I mean, I think there's probably a pragmatic reason why he wouldn't defect, at least now, and that's because it would just be seen as sour grapes, wouldn't it? I mean, he's just been sacked, and if the next week he then goes over to the Tories, that would just, it's the worst possible time for him to defect. The best time would have been whilst he was still in office. You know, if he decided that, you know, he wanted to do so on an issue of principle or something. Although even then, defecting from one coalition partner to another might have been seen as a bit weird. But
the only other time I think it might happen is just before David Cameron's last reshuffle.
Possibly.
They tempt him over with is you can be a minister.
But again, that would be seen as very, very self-serving, wouldn't it? I think politicians have to be very careful in situations like this, that even though we all know that when politicians defect, it is usually for personal reasons of either ambition or, you know, slight, they have to try and paint it as a, you know, as a great issue of principle. And I'm sure now's the wrong time. Even 6 months from now would be the wrong time. I'm not sure when the right time would be. Maybe, you know, when the, you know, after the next election, maybe, you know, if the Lib Dems end up in opposition, and, you know, I don't know. I don't know, but I can't see it happening right now. As for the general idea of whether he may defect at some point, I don't know. I think there are a number of Lib Dems and the kind of Orange Book faction, as it's described, although that in itself is quite misleading, because a number of the people who wrote for the Orange Book are, you know, people like Vince Cable and Chris Huhne, who are very much seen as, you know, social, on the social democratic wing as well. But it's a shorthand that gets used, so we'll use it. Yeah. You know, a number of them, like David Laws, Jeremy Brown, you know, there's a few others. I mean, Nick Clegg was one of them as well, I suppose. And, you know, there are questions sometimes as to why aren't they just Tories, but I don't think that takes into account the fact that, you know, the Liberal Democrats inherit a very strong political tradition that goes back hundreds of years. And so I don't think, put it this way, if Jeremy Brown was just really a Tory, why didn't he join the Tories 20 years ago? Why did he join the Lib Dems? You know, it's the same with David Laws. It's the same with Nick Clegg. They must have had reasons for joining the Liberal Party or the Liberal Democrats rather than the Tories. You know, if it was all about the, you know, the ministerial limo and, you know, spending half of the time when they are an MP in a party in government and having the chance of being a minister, they'd have joined the Tories. So, again, I think it's too simplistic to just say he's just a Tory in yellow clothing. I don't.
No, I agree. I say that a lot about people who say that about Labour people who are on the right of Labour. I really hate the "you're just a Tory" argument, because it's stupid. It negates why those people chose Labour, whether they chose it for the right reasons or not. They have chosen, and also, you know, we may go around the houses on this once more. But, you know, I suspect Jeremy Brown has a certain tribal instinct that has led him to stick with his party.
Possibly. And that's one area where being sacked in a pretty, what he probably perceives as unfair way, that's the kind of thing that might erode his tribalistic principles, maybe.
Yeah.
Just kind of speculating there. But because I think sometimes tribalism isn't really rooted in, you know, in kind of great issues of principle. It is just more, you know, you've always done it this way.
Yeah.
But Jeremy Brown probably never thought he'd be a minister anyway. So the fact that he was a minister for, you know, 3 years and, you know, now he's not anymore, I would hope he'd at least reflect and think, well, at least I had 3 years of it. And, you know, who knows, in the next reshuffle he may come back. I think Clegg might have had very specific reasons for wanting Baker in that position. And, you know, come the next reshuffle, who knows? And after the next election, Lib Dems might end up in government again. So, you know, I wouldn't be burning any bridges too quickly if I was one of the Lib Dem ministers who've lost their jobs recently, because you just don't know what's going to happen.
No. I mean, it's interesting, the whole "I've been a minister." I wonder whether having been a minister and having had a taste of being a minister makes it harder to contemplate not being a minister again.
Yeah, well.
For a long time.
Yeah, that's a difficult one to answer. I think only people who've been in that position can really know. But from what I've read and what I've heard, it is very seductive, and you know, it really does have its you know, it has its hold over you. So, yeah, good point.
Of course, there was also the reshuffle of the Labour front bench, which has been variously characterised as fresh blood, lots of 2010 intake, people being quite highly promoted. Or alternatively, if you prefer the, I'm trying to remember the word, the something of the Blairites, the purging of the Blairites, which is the other spin that has been put on it. Obviously, Liam Byrne was moved from welfare to higher education. Jim Murphy has been moved from defence to something else. I can't remember what. God, I'm really bad political commenter.
Come on, Emma, this is your party. Get with it. Get with the programme.
Well, you know, he's something. He's not, like, you know, defence minister anymore. I could barely remember his name when he was. I have a real blank when it comes to Jim Murphy.
Can you imagine if Nick Robinson was standing outside 10 Downing Street? Yeah, he's moved somewhere. I don't know. Back to the studio.
This is why I will never be Nick Robinson. And Stephen Twigg has been moved from education to, I think, the Home team. And there was an initial rejoicing from the left of the party that this was the end of some of the policies that they didn't like that the Labour team were coming out with. And that has since subsequently been quite strongly crushed by the fact that we haven't changed any of those policies, and the new people in post, Tristram Hunt and Rachel Reeves, see, I can remember some things, have been, you know, went out over the weekend to very strongly argue for the things that they wanted to continue doing.
Yeah, I mean, I think you rightly point out that in the case of both schools policy and welfare, there actually hasn't been a change. I mean, in the media, there's been some suggestion, speculation that this is a U-turn. I've seen it. I've seen the schools thing described as a U-turn, but actually it isn't a U-turn.
No, it's exactly the same policies we had 2 weeks ago.
But I think it's fair to say that there has been a bit of a change in emphasis. I think Hunt certainly seems to be pushing the line more strongly and making it very, very clear. And I think for good reason, making it very clear that they would not close down any free schools. I just don't think Labour could go into the next election promising to close down tens, hundreds of schools.
No.
It just wouldn't work. Exactly. It's just an electorally pragmatic reality that they couldn't do that.
Well, it's also a governing reality.
Yeah.
You cannot go in and just go, let's close down a bunch of schools.
Exactly.
Nothing to back it up. You know, you could, if you really, really wanted to, say that they must come under local authority control. But actually, local authorities are moving further and further from being involved in education.
Yeah.
And it's not necessarily where the Labour policy is going in terms of empowering communities, the kind of community-led stuff that we're really focused on.
Yeah.
It's not the same as empowering local government. Now, I personally think there should be a lot more empowering of local government, but that doesn't mean you have to do it in the same way they did in the 70s.
But the thing is, unless they were unequivocal about this, then there was always the risk that the Tories would spin it that Labour were planning secretly to close down these schools. So the fact that Hunt's come out very, very clearly and he used a news cycle in which to do it and made it clear that Labour will not be closing down these schools, and that, you know, the spin from the Labour side now is that they are on the side of parents who want to make choices. Although when you actually look at what the policy is that they'll be able to open these, I don't know what they call them, parent assisted schools or something,
parent academies.
Yeah, they're kind of like free schools, in all but name, but only in areas where, quotes, there is a need. And
yeah.
I think that is a definite difference.
Yes,
because
I mean, I think there is a real problem with the free schools movement in that they are opening up where there are where capacity isn't necessarily needed, and there's a huge capacity issue with a lot of areas in terms of school places at the moment. So a lot of the resources that are coming, because free schools get a lot of resource from government, yeah, they are not necessarily that unbureaucratic, because they're basically led by the Secretary of State.
Yeah.
And that resource and that capacity are going into areas where that resource and that capacity is not necessarily needed. And if we're talking in a time where resources are very, very tight, that's not what the focus should be.
Well, but I think we get to the heart of the policy difference here, don't we? Because the reason Gove wants free schools to be able to open wherever parents want them to is because what you define as there not being a need or there is already capacity, he would say, well, yeah, but the capacity isn't good enough. And so free schools being opened in those areas will give parents further choice and will also put pressure on the existing schools to up their game as well. Whereas Labour saying, well, you can't open them anywhere where there's already capacity, means that free schools can open where there's, you know, there is less capacity, fine, but in areas where there are already enough places, then there's no pressure on those schools to do better at all.
Well, there may or may not be. I mean, there are certainly inspection regimes which should be a pressure on those schools to do better. I mean, there are problems with what Michael Gove thinks is or isn't a good school. And
I thought you were just going to stop after the word thinks there.
Well, I mean, I know it's quite an old thing that's been going around this last week. It's had a re-enlightening of the comments he made in 2011 that all schools should be above average, which is an interesting approach to statistics.
Yeah, I think about 80% of drivers think that they're above average. Well, it's that sort of thing, isn't it?
So, you know, it's all very... But I think if what we're talking about is how to best manage resources under difficult circumstances. If we were at a time when the economy was different, then putting lots of resources into competition might have less implications for those areas where there is just not enough resource at all.
Yeah, but be honest, you would be opposed to it even then, and so would Labour probably.
I don't know enough about schools policy to say how strongly I'd feel about anything. To be honest with you, it's not my area. Mm. I get very concerned with the conversations that happen about schools policy because they focus on parents or they focus on teachers, and you very, very rarely hear any focus on children.
Mm.
And, you know, I
think that's an easy thing to say, but what would a focus on children entail?
Well, that's the question. I don't know. I don't know enough about education, but I think that there are serious issues around what is the best thing for children, whether or not that's the thing that parents want for them.
Okay.
So, or what is the best thing for children, whether or not that's what teachers want to do.
So, for example, the thing that Nick Clegg announced a few weeks ago about the free school meals for all infants in school. I mean, surely that is a pupil-focused
policy. It's a superb policy. I wish that... in Southwark, the Lib Dems hadn't been trying to stop us do it for quite so long.
There you go. You had to get some kind of gig in, didn't you?
Not least because my lovely, lovely friend Will works for the Southwark Lib Dems, so I have to have a little poke at Will.
But the point is that an example of a pupil-focused policy? Because I hear that kind of term bandied about, and really know what
it means. I think it's a great policy. I will absolutely hand the Lib Dems. That's a great policy. It's one I certainly hope that Labour continue when we're in office.
There was just one other thing I wanted to say, actually, about Tristram Hunt. And this is purely anecdotal, but I was at an event a few months ago. I was on a panel at Wellington College. God knows why they asked me, talking about education. I did my best. I talked about computer programming and in education, which is what I know about. Toby Young was on that panel as well, actually. That's where I first met him, as it happens. But straight afterwards, Tristram Hunt was on doing a Q&A. He did a little speech and then a Q&A. And at the time, he was junior shadow health minister, wasn't he, under Twig. I was amazed at how little... he seemed to grasp his brief. He was all over the place. And I'm not just saying this to score party points. You know, genuinely, I was surprised. I was there for about half an hour. He just didn't seem to know the answer to anything. And he even got a bit embarrassed at one point and said, you know, I can't remember how he tried to kind of bat it away, but it became clear that even he was quite embarrassed with how little. He was just deferring. He said, give me your address afterwards and I'll email address and I'll write to you. He was all over the place. And I don't know, maybe he was just having an off day, but I have to say, when it was announced that he's suddenly the shadow minister, and let's be honest, probably the minister if Labour get in, the way things are going, I don't know, I find it quite surprising.
I mean, it's interesting. I don't know the guy. I've never met him. I've never heard him speak. I've heard the complete opposite, and not just from Labour tribalists. Mm-hmm. But so it may have been a bad day, but it may not. I honestly couldn't tell you. Mm. And I'm not going to sit here and say I have seen him and he's incredible.
Well, no,
I can't.
Like I say, I'm not the sort of person to go around making, you know, snide attacks on people for no reason. It's just it really stuck in my mind because, you know, I see politicians of all parties, you know, in all kinds of different situations. And I'm usually quite impressed by them, no matter what party they're from. And it just really jarred with me that I wasn't impressed at all, especially given his background. You know, I mean, he's very expensively educated himself and, you know, he's a very renowned historian before he came into politics. So I really thought he'd have had a grasp of his brief, but I don't know, maybe it was just an off day or maybe, you know.
I mean, I have seen great politicians have off days and I've seen lousy politicians suddenly shine.
Yeah.
That may be the case, it may not be. I mean, I suspect if it is the case...
You'll get found out, won't you?
You'll find out pretty quickly and that'll be it.
yeah, fair point.
So, yes, I think we've pretty much covered the week that was. Reshuffle recriminations, conspiracy theories, drugs. Maybe they're connected.
Sounds like a good party, doesn't it?
Well, I don't know. Could you imagine being stuck in the corner with a stoned conspiracy theorist?
I'm sure I've been to... Yeah, I've definitely been to parties where I've been in that situation. Luckily, I don't remember much about them for reasons I'm not going to go into.
And, yeah, we flogged off the Royal Mail after 300 and something years. So there you go. It's quite interesting because it's described as a really Thatcherite move. But Thatcher herself had really, really strong feelings against privatising anything with the word royal.
Yeah, she said she didn't want to privatise the Queen's head.
Yeah. So, you know, it's more Thatcherite than Thatcherite, which is interesting because actually one of the things that's been discussed this week is what is a Blairite? What do we really mean by that? Mm. And, you know, I think there may well be a certain continuity Blairite movement who would actually reject a lot of what Tony Blair himself would have said and did as not Blairite enough. And I think that the Tories, certainly the Tories on the right, are now sometimes more Thatcherite than Thatcher. Mm. And maybe that's because we're far enough away from these ideologies having been in power for them to start crystallising into something beyond the pragmatism that actually comes with power.
Mm, maybe.
There, so, well, thank you very much, Mark. Lovely to talk to you as always. And I think we managed to get away without insulting each other too much.
Oh.
And I'd also like to thank Audio Boo for hosting the podcast and Kevin McLeod at incompetech.com for our funky theme music.